Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. It is Tuesday, December 3rd. Good to be back with you this week. This week, we're starting something new here at Faith and Family. We'll get into that in a little bit. I want to say thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting this program. If you want to find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin, just go to our website, kfuo.org. Look for the sponsor section, click on the CUW logo, and that'll take you to their page. Go check it out. Find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin. If you want to join the conversation today, you can do so. The number in the studio is 314-821-0850 or 1-800-730-2727, or you can email us, family@kfuo.org. We're going to be talking about a variety of things this week. Today marks the first day that we jump into our new format, and that is the common theme is it goes back to the catechism. So conversations and the catechism, but the whole conversation isn't about the catechism, but everything in life always comes back to the simple doctrines that are taught in the catechism. So today we're kicking things off with the first commandment. You shall have no other gods. What does this mean? We should fear, love, and trust in God above all things. Well, we know that fearing, loving, and trusting other gods often happens in every life, regardless of age, race, culture, and gender. And so today, we're going to travel around the globe, and we're going to hear from one of our missionaries who's been serving in a variety of places around the globe. Joining us by phone today, Michael Wade, international missionary. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for taking some time out of your schedule to talk with us today about your work as a missionary. Now, you have served in a variety of places. Reading through the stories that you shared with me, you've really served in some interesting places. Tell us a little bit about your background and what got you interested in becoming a missionary.
Well, I guess it began actually fairly young. I grew up on a farm. And liked agriculture. As I grew older in high school and college, learned about the other parts of the world that were in desperate need of food and economic development. My older brother, Kenneth, had gone into the ministry, and I was, but as a young person, I was petrified, actually still am, petrified of public speaking. And didn't think that I could possibly be a pastor giving a sermon every week, and decided that perhaps I could use my agricultural experience and education in useful ways in third world or other countries that in need of agricultural development, and so that was the field that I chose, and worked in secular jobs for a few years internationally before accepting a call to go to the Philippines by the LCMS, funded by LCMS World Relief, and joined a team of evangelists that were working with a tribal group on the island of Mindanao in the southern Philippines.
So When you went to the Philippines, which I'm sure today is probably a little bit different, when was that you went to the Philippines?
That would have been 1997.
And what did you set out to do while you were there? You say you have an agricultural background. What were the things that you set out to do when you went there with that team?
Well, the team requested an agricultural person to join them because they were working with a tribal group that was they were basically farmers living off the land. They were primarily subsistence farmers, growing what they needed to eat, grew corn, sometimes rice as a cash crop for some income. But these were on very steep slopes, mountainsides, very shallow soils, and the missionaries that were there thought if something isn't done, these people are not going to have a livelihood. Their soil's washing away, and we need some. They need help if they're going to maintain their lifestyle and their communities in these mountainous, rolling hills kind of environment. And so my initial goal was to with soil conservation. How can we help them maintain their soil and fields and productivity, but at the same time increase their produce and increase their production, increase their income through better soil management and crop management. So that's what we basically set out to try to do.
And someone might think, what does soil have to do with the gospel of Jesus? How did that connection happen?
Well, it gave us a way. A lot of people were interested in our program, and the Tagakalo, that's the name of the tribal group. The Tagakalo were, still are, very impoverished group. And they were, of course, interested in our program that was to aim to help them, and so they came to our meetings, to farmer meetings, but we always had one of the evangelists present to give a devotional, give a brief Bible study, depending on the group, but always some spiritual connection was made there. When we had our farmer meetings again, it was always centered around the church. We worked in communities. You didn't have to be a member to participate in our program, but it was the churches that were the focus of, you know, when we went into a village, we had the meetings in the church. It was primarily church members who were participating and drew in other people that were non-church members. And we tried very hard to avoid the, you know, people wanting to join the church so they could do our program. That wasn't, again, we made it very clear that it was welcome to non-members. But it did give those non-members, people who weren't believers, a chance to hear the gospel presented by our evangelists. When my language ability was good enough, I did led devotions myself, and we always had a spiritual aspect to our work. And so it was an outreach, basically allowing both our evangelists and church members to invite their neighbors to get them involved in our church activity, come to worship, etc.
So that was a big step for you. You were speaking in a new language, you were in a different culture, and you even stepped up to the plate to lead devotions from time to time. So that must have been a huge leap for you.
Yes, it was, and it was very challenging and very rewarding. The Tagakalo, when their church services were going, they usually lasted for 2 to 3 hours, and anytime a guest was present, they were always invited to speak, to give a sermon, basically. And even though I was not an evangelist, when I would be a guest at the church services, they would ask me to speak as well. And so, as my wife said, God has a sense of humor. Here I was, didn't want to be a pastor because I didn't want to have to do public speaking. And not only was I doing public speaking, I was doing it in a foreign language. So that was challenging, but again, rewarding. I didn't displace the pastors at all, but we had churches. And again, you know, we visited someplace every Sunday, and I was always invited to speak and had to have some kind of, I mean, it didn't have to be a whole 20-minute sermon, but at least a few minutes, 5 or 10 minutes worth of some kind of message.
A greeting in Jesus, it sounds like, a greeting in Jesus. What was the culture like for you, making that transition from American culture to this culture in the Philippines, to that particular group? How was it different than what you were used to, what you grew up with?
Well, it was, of all of the places we lived and served and worked overseas, this culture was probably the most different from our culture. It was a tribal group, and they have a very strong sense of community. You may have heard, or your listeners may have heard, you know, the Eskimo and our own American Indian, how their culture was centered around the community, and community is stronger than the individual. And this was, they were very much like that. And anyone who had something was expected to help those who didn't have. And the, I don't know what you would call it, the sharing, the back and forth, give and takes it. And they actually, probably the hardest part for us, a little different aspect, was they didn't value hard work. They valued being able to get something done without working. And so, like, the village that we lived in, the leader, our village leader, was, by our standards, the laziest person around. And he could make his living by horse trading, as we might call it, or, you know, I don't know how to explain, but, and it was hard to really understand how he made a living, but he did very little work, had a very small farm, and it usually was not very productive, but they managed to live and survive. And on the other end of our village was one person who, by our standards, was, you know, this was a go-getter. He was off every morning, he and his wife, to the field, and they were plowing and cultivating and planting and harvesting and, you know, all of these things. And he was had the least standing in the village. You know, when he was a church member, but he was never elected to any offices in the church or any position, and he was not considered, you know, by us, he was the best guy in town, but by their standards, he was the worst, because, look, he had to work every day, you know, and then when he did make, you know, something, people always came to him to borrow, and when they asked to borrow, you were expected to give, and so anybody who had, it was very hard to get ahead, because if you had something, your neighbor or your brother or your cousin or somebody would come, and they knew you had a good harvest, so they knew you had money, and they would come and borrow. And so it was trying to find a way to help people. You know, we had a program where we distributed seed and fertilizer, corn seed and fertilizer, and some of the people used the corn seed and the fertilizer and planted and had a good crop, but others, and this is a very poor community, and it's hard to understand from our point of view, but when you have nothing, somebody gives you a bag of fertilizer and your child is sick and needs to go to the doctor and you have no money to pay for that, you sell the fertilizer. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible decision agriculturally, of course, but it gives you the cash that you need to pay for your child's medicine.
Yeah, you don't have time to grow the crop to get the money to pay for the medicine.
Exactly. But, mm-hmm. you know, then it's a downward cycle, of course. You get you're given the fertilizer, but you don't use it, so you have a poor crop. So your income is less than it should have been, and, you know, and so there you go. You have, and that's the kind of trying to, again, find ways to help people. To not, as we would say, shoot themselves in the foot by, you know, selling their seed or not using the fertilizer properly or selling it or whatever. And they were very, you know, it sounds negative, but tricky is the only word I can think of. Very conniving at ways to manipulate and get things, again, without working. Because that was their value. I mean, their value was, you know, why should you work if you don't have to? And so that was a big challenge.
So perhaps the word creative comes to mind, creative mm-hmm. About their approach. What was the religious life like in, what was religion like in the Philippines and the in the community that you were in the Philippines?
The kind of the national religion is a form of Catholicism, and most people had some sense of that. Our tribal people, this group that we worked with, were isolated enough from mainstream Philippine culture that they really weren't into that very much. There had been a lot of missionary work by other people, Pentecostal churches and other denominations have worked in the area. Some people followed them, some people didn't. What the basic even churchgoers still adhered to a form of animism. They believed that their ancestors could come back and influence things, and they were generally afraid of them. I'm not sure why they thought the ancestors were not nice, but they didn't. They were worried about appeasing the ancestral spirits. Sometimes it even evolved. It went to certain places or plants, trees, that kind of thing. But the primary concern were these ancestral spirits that would do them harm.
So it's probably pretty different than what most people in North America have grown up with in terms of the culture and lifestyle. What are some things that you would say were similar? Were there things that were similar during the time that you were there in the 90s?
Well, family is strong. And that's pretty universal, I think, as parents, and we want the best for our children. We want to help our children. And they were they saw the value of education, that great sacrifices by parents and even grandparents to get children at least through high school. The high school, sometimes they had to move. They couldn't live in their villages, didn't have high school, and they had to either go by foot because these were trails that you got out to the main roads, and the distance was too great at time. Was too great, and so they'd have to move to town and live with a relative or a friend, or sometimes even a boarding house. But usually, there was some family connection where they could live in a town that had a high school, and even then, the next step, of course, was college. And we saw in our time there saw a few people begin to get out and to go to college, which was a huge step. So. That was similar. People trying to get an education, trying to improve life for themselves, for their kids. We saw migration. People, in my generation, people leaving the farm to go to town to get a job or get an education, mm-hmm. and didn't want to be a farmer. And that's the same thing we saw, people wanting to escape poverty, saw the getting to town, getting to the city, and getting a job, which didn't always happen, but they're just like in our country. We saw that migration and that value. Health, of course, similar. People would do extraordinary effort to get health care for their family, even elderly people that perhaps didn't have much longer to live. They would try to get the best care they could for them. So, and those two, health and education, very similar to ourselves or to our own culture.
So you spent 4 years in on the island of Mindanao and in the Philippines. I'm sure that things have changed over the years, and actually tomorrow we'll be talking with our team that recently, the disaster response team from the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod that went to follow up after Typhoon mm-hmm. Haiyan. We'll be talking with them about how things are now. Yeah. They were particularly, they visited Cebu and Tacloban and Leyte. So we'll talk with them tomorrow about that. But out of your time there, What would you say you gained from your interaction with that tribe and with the people in on the island of Mindanao?
I think just a greater appreciation for different values and how people make it through life. Not necessarily aspiring to the same things that I aspire to or that I see as beneficial. Their sense of, donation contributions to other people, sense of community, less focus on myself and a greater sense of hospitality was just incredible amongst the people, and how it's more important to spend time in relationships than spending time in getting our work done. I think perhaps it's probably the thinking about it. Never been asked that question before.
It's a deep question, huh?
So probably that. I would say that mm-hmm. just the trying to be more personable and more relationship focused and less job work focused, and not that I need to abandon that, but mm-hmm. just, you know, a better balance.
Sure. And after serving then in the Philippines, then you served in Argentina for a while. Is that correct?
Yep.
Tell us about what you set out to, what you went there to do, and the people you served there.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was a very different setting and a very different goals. In Argentina is much more developed than the Philippines. It's, you know, not on par with the U.S., but not too far behind, not what you would call a third world country. I was asked to come there by a pastor and an agricultural person who was a prominent member of the church in the northern area of the Argentina called the Chaco. The Chaco is it's a geographical region, but it's also political. There is a province of Argentina called the Chaco, and we were there to work with, I'm not real sure how to describe it, a group of people that were in kind of an isolated, backward part of the country, like what we might have say the Ozarks or Appalachia, the people that are kind of left behind, somewhat disenfranchised. And we were there to work specifically with a church. There's an established Lutheran church that's in fellowship with the LCMS in Argentina. Most of Argentina, at least, well, that's certainly the Lutheran churches, are all in towns and cities and members who are, like many North Americans, descendants of European ancestors, the immigrants from Italy and Germany and European countries that came just like they came to the United States, they came to the Argentina. These are primarily European, Caucasian people, and all of the Lutheran churches are of just like us, a German and descent. And but this one church, the only church in the whole Lutheran Church of Argentina, was a group of people called the Mestizos, which were not European descent. They were actually people that developed out of from way back. The conquistadors came and took native wives and children that just started in the conquistador days in the 16th, 15th century. So whereas the Lutherans all had German and European sounding names, this church had Spanish names. You know, it was the Gonzales and Alfredo and, you know, names like that, whereas the Germans were Walter and and German names Schlenker. And so, but this group again was they were all farmers, the very rural area, and we went there to try to see what we could do to help them. Again, Argentina has resources, but these people, again, somewhat disenfranchised, weren't connected mm-hmm. to the university research, the extension services that were available. And so in that setting, my goal there was just to try to organize these small, they were mostly small farmers, small scale farmers, organize them in as a cooperative or a farmer group, and so that they could, as a group, access agricultural extension services, mm-hmm. even companies like cotton was a big crop there. There was cotton gin, and the cotton gin would provide seed and inputs to the farmers. But these were large-scale farmers, and our people weren't able to access that gin because they, you know, they're growing 1 or 2 acres, and the gin didn't care about that. They wanted, you know, they dealt with farmers of 100 and 200 and 300 acres. But when they, as a group, they operated as a cooperative, collectively they could, you know, get the interest and the response from the cotton gin, could get their seed and herbicides and things that they needed, acting as a group. And even after I left, for instance, the group that we formed eventually won an award from the Japanese government, gave them a brand new John Deere tractor.
Wow.
To work with this group.
Let's take a pause there. We need to take a break.
Yes. Okay.
And when we come back from the break, I want to hear more about the Chaco and the people of the northern area in Argentina, the farmers you worked with there as well.
Okay.
So we'll do that when we come back from the break. Before we go to the break, I've got a little bit of trivia for our listeners today, because it's Giving Tuesday and I feel like giving something away today. So we're going to do that. We have some copies. We have some of the new CDs from the National Lutheran Choir called Emmanuel. So for our listeners today, if you can email me answering this trivia question, who do we commemorate on Friday, December 6th this week, to our listeners? Email us family@kfuo.org, or you can call 314-821-0850 or 1-800-730-2727, and we're going to play a nice selection from the National Lutheran Choir on our way out. Who do we commemorate on December 6th in the church year? So stick around for more right here on Faith of Family on Worldwide KFUO.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of Inspiration in Action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Recently, I asked a pro-abortion feminist why she supports the St. Louis Planned Parenthood. She didn't answer, and here's why. The Missouri Department of Health inspected the abortion mill and came up with 14 pages of violations. Some of them include not following protocols to prevent infection, having rusty surgical tables, suction machines, and IV stands, layers of dust everywhere, and inappropriate handling of drugs. Over the last 6 years, at least 25 women were sent to the hospital because of botched abortions. Staff at the abortion mill blamed it on a new trainee abortionist. They're allowing new staff to practice on women with alarming results. Now who's engaging in a war on women? It's the abortion industry that's maiming and killing women and their babies.
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, inviting you to join us for Issues Etc. weekday afternoons from 3 to 5. Issues Etc. is a live call-in show with a twofold purpose. First, we defend and teach the truths rediscovered during the Reformation, grace, faith, scripture, and Christ alone. Second, we challenge today's postmodern culture with its unbiblical ideology.
Issues Etc. live weekday afternoons from 3 to 5 on KFUO Radio.
Two pastors, one an Italian wise guy, and the other a Ukrainian academic. What happens when you put them in the same room with no script and a bunch of sound effects? Well, you're just going to have to tune in to find out. The God Whisperers are coming to KFUO on Thursday from 2 to 3 p.m. Central. They're fun-loving, a little off the wall, but always solidly Lutheran. You will learn something every time or double your money back. It's okay to enjoy being Lutheran.
Hi, this is Rich Robertson, the president of the Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Did you know it only takes a few words or a kind gesture to lift up someone in need of hearing the gospel? You can help LCMS Ministries concentrate on doing more and reaching more. With the Lutheran Church Extension Fund investment, you empower ministries with loans and resources that keep the mission moving forward. Investments directly benefit LCMS schools, congregations, care centers, universities, and international ministries. Visit lcef.org or call 800-843-5233.
The U.S. Supreme Court has turned away a Christian university's attempt to overturn a key part of the Obama administration's health care law. The justices did not comment Monday in leaving in place a federal appeals court ruling dismissing Liberty University's lawsuit. Liberty challenged the portion of the health care law that requires most employers to provide health insurance to their workers or pay a fine. The 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals rejected those claims. But Liberty Council Chairman Matt Stavis says,
"This is certainly far from over. Our challenge was to the face of the statute, but once it's applied to Liberty University through a fine or penalty, we'll have another claim and we'll be back in court."
The school founded by the Reverend Jerry Falwell teaches
that God is the creator of life and abortion is murder.
The Supreme Court separately is considering whether for-profit corporations can mount religious objections to the law's requirements to include birth control among preventive health benefits. I'm Steve Coleman.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. It is Tuesday, December 3rd. We have the best listeners in the world. That's because we're worldwide KFUO, so we have listeners all over the world. Congratulations to our listeners, Nancy in Alton, Illinois, and Scott in Altamont, Illinois, for getting the answer correct on our trivia today. The answer Friday is Nicholas of Myra. We often call it St. Nicholas Day on Friday. So thanks for listening and calling in or emailing in with your answers. National Lutheran Choir CD, Emmanuel, is headed your way. So thanks for listening. Back to our conversation. Joining us on the phone today, Michael Wade, missionary who's served all over the globe. We talked about serving in the Philippines. Now on to his time in Argentina in the northern region called the Chaco region, correct?
That's correct, yes.
And so you went there, and it was very different than the environment that you served in the Philippines. It was a little, it was much more, what was the word you described, the more developed. And so your work there was to partner with the small farmers, correct?
That's right, yes.
And so
and
tell
try
us,
to organize them again, organizing them into groups with a cooperative effect to be able to function collectively like a single large-scale farmer.
And so I'm sure trying to organize groups like that is quite an overwhelming adventure. Just serving as a church worker, as the director of Christian education, trying to organize groups of people, it's no simple task. How did you go about that?
Well, we had the assistance. Again, I mentioned earlier that it was a pastor of one of the churches and his member who, an agricultural person himself, who worked with the Argentine Agricultural Extension Service. And so we worked collaboratively with him and with people within the Extension Service to form these groups, and they were a great help. We collectively, working together, were able to establish farmer groups, and it was, it's a challenge always to get people to work together. And again, these people were not, well, they're poor, but not, they didn't worry about where their next meal was coming from poor, like the people in the Philippines. But, you know, they were very modest incomes and lived certainly by, you know, our standard, they were poor, but again, they were. It wasn't survival. It was just, you know, how can they do better?
Mm-hmm. And what was the culture like there when it coming back to the topic of religion in that community that you lived and served in?
Well, this was like Latin America. Catholicism is strong, much stronger than it was in the Philippines. And these people, too, were come from a Catholic background culture, if you will. Most people had been baptized in the Catholic Church, but very few attended. Not on a regular basis. In fact, this was remote enough that even they didn't have priests in the churches. They just came some areas as seldom as once a year, where they would have services and baptize babies that were born that year. There was no confirmation. When people were married, they often married in the church. The priest came and did that. But that was about the extent of their activity with the church and their knowledge of the church. If you ask them, they would say they were Catholic, but if you ask them very deep spiritual questions, and I mean not even deep questions, very basic questions about, you know, well, what does the Catholic Church believe and what do you believe, and it was they didn't know what the church believed. Their belief tended to be fairly strong in what's the word? Sorry. Old age is getting to me.
No, you're doing just fine.
images they had, that they would have a statue of Mary enshrined, and on the roadsides there'd be a little, you know, mm-hmm. glass shrine with an image of Mary inside it, or other saints. And they even had some of their own saints. When I say own saints, not saints canonized by the Catholic Church, but people that they believed. There was one guy in particular that supposedly had healing powers, and when he was alive, and went around healing people, and not in the name of Jesus, but just in his by his own force, was able to supposedly heal people, and after his death, he was considered a saint, and people would make pilgrimages to his hometown and his burial spot, and believed that he had healing powers.
And that's really that brings us back to the the theme this week, the first commandment, you shall have no other gods. How did you respond to that? Witnessing that for the first time, what was your response just internally when you started seeing that and learning about that?
Well, dismay that they could take something that's basically good. Mary was, chosen by God to be mm-hmm. the mother of our Savior, but to make her into essentially a god, or to make other people that were good people live good lives, perhaps, but to elevate them to a level of, deity was very disconcerting mm-hmm. that they would do that, and it was hard to see.
Did you ever have opportunities to talk about that in that culture with the people you worked with?
Well, yes and no. Again, we were working with the people, members of the church. We did outreach, to people who didn't believe. It was the difficulty arose when you tried to address issues like that. They would say, well, we're Catholic, and then you would say, well, we believe that Jesus is God. Oh, yes, well, that's right. And, they wouldn't disagree with anything you said, because it was more or less what they understood, perhaps understood that the Catholic Church believed. And so, and they'd say, well, that statue, that shrine you've got there, oh, well, that's not God. We know that. That's just somebody that we pray to, and they're going to help us. And they're intermediate for God. And, they wouldn't verbalize that they believed that this statue in the house or on the roadsides were deity, but, it certainly appeared that that's...
Sure, they wouldn't call them that in name, but it sounds like they would treat them in that same manner.
Exactly, yes. And because they didn't have it wasn't the cross, it wasn't, Jesus that they made in the shrines. It was always somebody else. Again, Mary was probably the most common, but mm-hmm. Other saints as well, Peter, Paul,
And bringing up in conversation, we're looking at other cultures, but to turn our, turn my fingers around and point right back at my own culture, we do that very same thing in the culture in which I live. We do that with celebrities quite often. We do that with a number of people and things too. We make idols out of things that were created rather than the creator. And we worship them and look to them for special powers that really, that those gifts, everything that we have is all a gift from the Lord, and we're given to worship Him and to serve Him. The idolatry in that sense, I'm sure, was disconcerting. Tell us more about any other interesting stories from your time in Argentina that really stand out.
My wife was... Anne was very involved as well in the ministry. Actually, she in the Philippines too. We did youth group and vacation Bible school or that kind of thing in the Philippines, and then she did that as well in Argentina. And she also taught English in some of the rural schools, and so we had quite a distribution of connections. And it was just the Argentines are very, again, very hospitable, open people, and it was, and they, again, like the Filipinos, but perhaps coming from a more Western culture, they were more interested in relationships. They were hardworking. They did work hard, very hard. And they're agricultural, and a lot of the people that we in the Chaco, the rural people, made their living from the forest. They made charcoal, fence posts, telephone poles, things that they harvested out of the woods, and that's very demanding work. But they also knew how to to relax and enjoy one another and take time for relationships in a way that I think we have trouble with in North America. And the materialism was not nearly so great. It was just to see the Lutheran Church, the church body, the way the pastors came together. When they had a conference, they met at churches. They didn't go to the hotels in town. They put people up in their homes. The women of the church and sometimes even the community would come together to serve the food and prepare the meals for the men as they met and had their conventions or whatever. Youth group the same way. Youth group all gathered. They spent their evening, they stayed in tents or in homes. The churches did everything, the cost for a 3-day youth conference or convention was like $25. So people could afford to come, and it was just wonderful to see how they came together and worked and supported and helped one another to make their meetings and conferences happen.
A very resourceful people, and one of their biggest resources was hospitality, it sounds like.
Yes, that's very true.
Well, we've got from Argentina, you served one more people group, so we move back over to the other side of the globe again, correct?
That's right.
Tell us about the third place that you served.
Okay, the third place was in Central Asia, in a country called Kyrgyzstan. Kyrgyzstan is a small country, about the size and climate of Nebraska, same latitude, so it's a cold climate, except that instead of being in the plains, it was mountainous. Kyrgyzstan is like 90% mountains, and we worked there. There's two major valleys in the country for agricultural production, and we lived and worked in one of those. These Kyrgyzstan is in Central Asia is one of many countries that were states of the Soviet Union, got their independence in 1990 or 91 when the Soviet Union broke up, and have been independent countries since then, but a very strong influence from Russia and the Soviet Union still today in language and economy. We worked, and it's a Muslim country, and we worked with a minority group. The focus there was a people group called the Dungan, who ironically were Chinese Muslims who escaped from China to get away from religious persecution because the Muslims were not well received in China. And they came to Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, the country to the north, because they were Muslim countries. And so they came, immigrated from China to Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, but then this was in the 1800s, were soon absorbed by the Soviet Union, and their religion was outlawed, and so they were even less able to practice their Muslim religion there than they were in China, where they'd left to escape that persecution. But of course, the Soviet Union broke up, and so now they're free to practice, and there are mosques and people who populate them. The people group that we worked with are committed Muslims. They attend the mosque, do their prayers, whereas the general Kyrgyz population, even though they're very much like Catholicism in Latin America, if you ask a guy on the street, he would say he's Muslim, but he doesn't go to the mosque, he doesn't know what the Quran says, he doesn't participate or know anything about the religion.
So the group that you worked with, a very small group, but was very dedicated to their religion. You said they were faithful in attendance at the mosque. What then was your involvement with them?
Well, again, there were evangelical missionaries on the field there. This Dungan people are all farmers. They came from China. They have the Chinese work ethic and produce a high percentage of the vegetables for the country, even though they're only like 1 or 2% of the population. They are the leaders in carrot, potato, cucumber, tomatoes, those kinds of crops they produced. They didn't have a lot of land. Land was divided up when the Soviet Union broke up again, and private ownership of land was allowed. Most of them own maybe 5 acres or something like that, and so to make a living, they have to produce intensive crops, high value intensive crops, because people that did have larger acres grow wheat and corn and crops like that. But if you only have a couple acres, then you can still make a living growing, again, high value crops like potatoes and tomatoes and even strawberries and that sort of thing.
And in working with them side by side, in working with these farmers, were they receptive to the message of Jesus?
No. They liked to talk about religion. They weren't opposed to that. They weren't put off if carried on a conversation, tried to have a conversation about religion. And, you know, we tell them what Christianity believes, and then they tell us what the Muslim believe about that. And it was, you know, they didn't offend them, but there was very little interest in, mm-hmm. in converting. It was very difficult to get people interested in Jesus. Actually, they believe in Jesus. They believe that Jesus, the Muslims, that he was a prophet, mm-hmm. not that he was the Son of God. On the other hand, they do believe that he'll come back at the end time and be involved in the judging of people, so that his spirit, his person, is still, you know, viable and will reappear, but they don't consider him deity. They don't, and that was the
with about step that, with about half a minute left, what did you? Okay. sorry, our time is going quickly. With about half a minute left, what did you gain from your time there in Kyrgyzstan?
Well, non-spiritually, I gained a greater appreciation for the Soviet Union. you know, we were pretty indoctrinated how awful the Soviet Union was, but we saw that they did a lot of good things, and people there are very happy with the Soviet Union. Spiritually, learning about the Muslim religion was a challenge and interesting, but realizing how difficult it is for a Muslim to convert to Christianity. And again, they have faith. You know, they believe in God, the Father of Abraham, just don't. It's going to accept Jesus as God, as the Son of God. It was something that's very hard for them to do. And culturally, it's a very, very big step for them to deny their Muslim beliefs and convert to Christianity.
We've been talking with Michael Wade, missionary to serve all over the globe for Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Thanks so much, Michael, for your service and for spending some time talking with us today about that.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me, inviting me. I appreciate it.
God's blessings. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue the conversation. We're going to talk with our friends who served on the disaster response team in the Philippines. And want to say thanks to the National Lutheran Choir for providing the CDs for our giveaway today. Their upcoming concert is this Saturday, December 21st. To find out more about that here in the St. Louis area, just visit nlca.com. Go check it out, nlca.com, if you want information on tickets, Saturday, December 21st, 2 and 5 p.m. Thanks for joining us for Faith and Family.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.